The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Frisch, Judge Johnson, and Judge Shellhaus. The Honorable Jennifer Frisch presiding. First case is A20-0279, Community Housing Services, Park Towers Incorporated versus Julie Gay.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is September 24, 2020. We have two cases on our oral argument calendar this morning. The marshal has already called the first case. Before you begin, counsel, please mute your microphone if you are not speaking. The marshal will show the running clock of your time. Please keep an eye on the clock. Please identify yourself and your client for the record before beginning your argument. Each party will have 15 minutes for their primary argument. The appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. And with that, counsel, you may proceed.
William French for Julie Gay, appellant in this case. May it please the court, Ms. Nelson. Julie Gay, at the time of this action, was a 74-year-old woman who had suffered two strokes, had no family, was not married, but most importantly, I think, was a retired journalist. She had worked for years at the Rochester Post-Bulletin in Rochester, Minnesota. I think the mere fact that this action was brought and originally scheduled on Christmas Eve of 2019 underscores the anger that this landlord felt for this retired journalist. And also, we know that people like Ms. Gay are from a low caste in our culture. And I'm relying upon the book of Caste by Isabella Wilkerson, which has been long listed for a National Book Award and maybe the best nonfiction book written in the United States in 2019. People like Ms. Gay are simply expected to come in to an eviction action and do what I think is properly termed walk the plank. She elected not to do that. She requested a trial. She requested a jury trial. So what will this case stand for if it's affirmed? Number one, and keeping in mind that there is going to be a tsunami of eviction actions proceeding in the courts of this state as we move through this year, there'll be more evictions and more homelessness. And this is a very important case for this court to consider the applicable statutes. Number one, there'll be no trials in eviction actions because landlords will quickly realize they can bring a summary judgment, perhaps even orally, on the day set for a trial, and the case will be dismissed.
Now, I mean, that's not what happened here, right? I mean, the district court excluded evidence relating to one of multiple affirmative defenses.
That's true, but it will stand for the principle that the whole principle is you can bring a summary judgment, what amounts to a summary judgment motion on the first day of trial without any notice, which there was no notice in this case, and your case can be dismissed. A summary judgment will apply not just to affirmative defenses, but to the merits of the case. And given the existing bias, you know, landlord bias that exists down here in Olmsted County, there will be no trials.
Now, in this case, the district court said it would not consider there were no summary judgment motions filed, at least no motions with that label that were actually filed. There were motions in limine filed. The district court said it would consider the motions in limine, and it granted motion in limine number 5, right?
Well, that's right, Your Honor. A motion in limine is normally related to expected evidence that may be prejudicial to the party. For example, if somebody had a long criminal history, the requirements of using that for impeachment would have to be considered in a motion in limine. It's not about the merits of a case. And there has been a trend in recent years, in this case, this court must be aware of it, for motions in limine to be converted into summary judgment motions. I'm a strong believer in the rules of civil procedure, but they're being widely ignored in the case of evictions. Whether that is
counsel, having served on the district court in Hennepin County and Judge Frisch in Ramsey County, we know that there are special rules that apply to unlawful detainer actions that allow in those districts oral motions for summary judgment to be brought on the day of trial. Now, I recognize that your district hasn't adopted those rules, but it's difficult for me to accept the argument that this is so unfair when the Supreme Court has approved of those housing rules in our two largest judicial districts in the state.
I'm not aware of the rules in Hennepin and Ramsey County, and I want to remind the court, and I've argued this in federal court, Olmsted County is not Hennepin nor Ramsey County. They are two separate worlds and reflected in how the laws are applied down here. That's simple to understand. So we don't have...
Even by statute, Mr. French, isn't it true, and the statutes say that the normally applicable procedural rules are different if there are different provisions in 504B point, I think it's 281 to 371, right?
No, you're right, Judge, but there was no note. I guess there was no notice. If this court wants to stand for the proposition that you can bring a summary judgment on the day of trial, there's nothing I can do about it. I want to move on to the informer pauperis issue. Are courts required to follow Minnesota Statute 56301, subdivision 1C? Is it just a mathematical calculation designed to keep people out of court who are a little bit over? And I will note that in the federal system, you get...
Mr. French, do you mean 3C?
Yes, exactly. I'm sorry.
Okay, thank you.
3C. And here's another interesting point. The form that is used in this doesn't even consider 56301 3C. It doesn't even have it on there. I've been down this road before where what I call retrograde law, where forms undermine statutes. This form undermines this statute. It allows judges to apply this statute in a strictly mathematical computation without regard to 3C, which I think is illegal. And I think it's an abuse of discretion unless the court submits findings that 3C doesn't apply. In this case, if you look at form, I think it's add 8 to add 10 that was submitted by Ms. Gay, she indicates she suffered two strokes, she has medical bills, she has rent, she has all these things. If this case doesn't qualify for consideration of 56301 subdivision 3C, no case does. But I think we have to relate this to Ms. Gay as a low caste person. And simply, I think low caste people are, the point is to exclude them from the court system so they don't clog things up. But believe me, there's going to be a big tsunami of these people. Are people now facing eviction, homeowners that can't pay their mortgages? Are they going to be subjected to this very, I say, a legal interpretation? There's no finding of fact here that she wasn't entitled to that. If anybody, any person with any humanity would have looked seriously at that affidavit, they would have given her a break, but they didn't because they don't want her in the courthouse.
3C, of course, is not an entitlement. I mean, unlike 3A and 3B, which if certain objective facts are established, then a person's entitled to IFP status. 3C appears to be a provision where the district court may order a reduced or partial payment. But it's not. So I guess the question I think you're raising is whether one way to reframe your argument is to say that a district court is obligated to consider that in every case. And perhaps, I think maybe what you're arguing is the district court is obligated to make a finding or to make a statement about the possibility of a reduced fee under 3C in every case, even if the applicant has not requested it. Is that essentially what you're asking?
That's a fair analysis, a judge. I think people who don't have money and don't have unlimited financial resources should be given a break.
Why not? Of course, I mean, the IFP statute is designed to provide greater access to the court for the very people you're describing. I think that's the entire, that's the purpose of the entire statute. But of course, there are criteria and there are thresholds. 3C is, it appears to me, to be an opportunity for a district court to, by its grace or discretion, or to give somebody a benefit to which they're not necessarily entitled, but which the district court thinks would be appropriate in that case. But the question is, what procedures surround that?
Well, Your Honor, I think the form that's approved by the state should include that option. It doesn't. Judges don't have to consider it and don't consider it. That's what I'm informing this court of. Judges down here don't consider it. It's simply a mathematical calculation. That's how people are being treated in Olmsted County. I think it's wrong. I may be in the minority, apparently I am, but I think it's wrong not to consider, and I think it's an abuse of discretion for judges not to consider it. It should be on the form. Okay, let's move on to, when do you have to file a bond in a case like this? And this case is going to stand for the proposition that all you have to say is you're going to do it. You don't have to do it. And really, when you look at how the statute works, you could get a person out of a property within 48 hours. I mean, the sheriff would have come and will come and move somebody out after 48 hours, because when an appeal is a plan for an appeal is stated on the record, you get 24 hours. But a court could issue a writ of restitution, and when that is served, you get an additional 24 hours. I've been in that whole process. I got the form changed because the form didn't use the state 24 hours. I've been in federal court on that issue. But anyways, so all you have to say is that you're going to file a bond. This law is tilting so much in favor of landlords just at a time in this state when people most need the protection of the law. And so that is a problem. Also, I guess I think you don't have to have a judgment anymore to get a writ of restitution. You can just say, it's meaningless.
So, but Mr. French, yes, your third argument is that the writ of recovery was void ab initio, you say, because a judgment had not been entered. And in looking at the statutes, I don't see a statute or statutory provision that plainly says that they must be done in this order: judgment first, issuance of writ of recovery after that.
Well, that's in the statute.
Where? Can you point to it, please?
I don't have the statute right in front of me, but it's in the statute. You have to have a judgment before you can issue a writ of restitution.
Okay, but the word before being the key issue, obviously there must be a judgment in connection with the case, but where does it say that the judgment must be entered before the writ of recovery is issued?
I've stated my argument in my brief. I don't have it right in front of me, but
I think you've referred. I'm just trying to try to focus on the nitty gritty of your argument. I think you've referred to 3.345 sub 1A, and that has two sentences. The first sentence says the court shall immediately enter judgment. The second sentence says the court shall blah, 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 immediately issue a writ of recovery. Now, I was surmising that your argument is based simply on the order of those two sentences. The fact that the first sentence refers to the judgment, the second sentence refers to the writ, because I don't see anything in there in the language that says the first must happen before the second. But is that your argument?
Yes, it is. And the judgment, our whole Anglo-American jurisprudence revolves around judgments. You can't do anything until there's a judgment. You can't appeal in this case. And I think it's wrong to issue a writ of recovery before you have the right to appeal. We can't appeal without a judgment. If I filed an immediate appeal in this case, it would have been dismissed. You have to have the right to appeal a case. People need that right. I don't know why we want to deny people the right to appeal decisions they don't agree with. enter allowing the to say judgment's no big deal, I don't think that's appropriate, given its role in Anglo-American jurisprudence. Now I want to move on to, I don't think anybody should request a jury in an eviction action, because the court is going to decide the case based on as though it were a court trial. If I'd known this case was going to be decided by the judge without having the jury who had been sitting there listening to this case decide the case, I wouldn't have wasted my time in bringing this matter. I was counting on the jury. There's so many things that could have been argued to the jury in this case. Number one, the anger felt toward this woman because she had the temerity to contact Building and Saving about this ubiquitous bed bug problem in this building. I would argued that she signed the intent to vacate under duress, or it wasn't a voluntarily an intelligent waiver. And there would have been many things.
Counsel, I see that your time has expired. Is there anything else from the panel? All right, thank you very much. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal, counsel. Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel?
Thank you. Excuse me, Carrie Nelson, representing Respondent Community Housing Park Towers. May it please the court, at Bedrock, this is a case about Ms. Gay on October 16, 2019, agreeing to move out on December 1st, 2019, and then just flat out refusing to vacate. She was a holdover tenant at that point, and the trial court properly found that she was a holdover tenant at that point. And the holdover tenancy is what was alleged in the eviction action complaint, which is document number one in the record. And I would refer the court to the intent to vacate notice that she signed. And Ms. Gay elected not to testify or put in any evidence. She rested immediately after the landlord rested in this case. And so some of the things that Mr. French says that he wanted to argue to the jury are not in the court record. So they're really not relevant. And so the trial court correctly held that Ms. Gay was holding over. The intent to vacate notice indicates that the reason for moving is a mutual lease termination. Ms. Gay signed this in lieu of the previous termination notice. That was a unilateral. The intent to vacate notice was mutual. And so, Your Honors, the Minnesota statute section 504B.285 subdivision 1 says that a landlord can recover possession by eviction after termination of the time for which the premises is demised or leased to the person. And that's what happened here. The Ms. Gay signed her mutual termination or her intent to vacate notice, which clearly says once your notice has been given, you cannot change your mind and remain in your unit. But she tried to do that. She didn't. There's testimony that she did not come and ask for an extension. There have been other residents who asked for extensions and those were granted. And I think perhaps the most important and salient point here is that the December 1st date, the move-out date, was picked by Ms. Gay. She came in, met with management. Management said, what would be a reasonable move-out date? And she said December 1st. And so the complaint was then filed on December 4th after she just said, nope, I'm not moving. And the initial hearing was set for December 19th, 16th or 19th, and then was moved a few days. And we had a court trial very quickly. That's how evictions work. A jury trial very quickly. And so Ms. Gay was represented by counsel throughout this entire process. And Mr. French mentioned something about the case originally being scheduled on Christmas Eve. There is nothing in the record about scheduling on a Christmas Eve. The initial hearing was held on the 19th, and then the jury trial was scheduled for starting December 30th.
Ms. Nelson, could you please turn to the third issue, which the third argument is that the writ was void because it was issued before the judgment was entered.
Your Honor, I think that your interpretation of the statute is the correct one.
I'm not there's sure what my interpretation is.
The interpretation that you read where there's two separate sentences and the writ is not based on entry of the judgment. The writ is something that the court issues, and obviously the statute says that the judgment is supposed to be entered immediately. That's one of the unique things about eviction cases. Ordinarily, judgment is something that the court administrator is directed to do, at some point after the trial.
Well, both, and, I mean, that if you're referring to point 345 sub 1A, both the judgment shall be entered immediately and the writ shall be issued immediately. The word immediately is used for both. To me, that doesn't necessarily suggest an order in which, or to require that the two acts be done in necessarily one before the other. But I guess what I'm saying is that could be what the law requires, but that language by itself to me does not expressly say that. That's the only thing I'm sure of right now. But I should just ask you, I mean, how is this supposed to work? And in this case, did the district court follow the best practices or what the law requires?
Your Honor, how it generally works is that the judgment is entered immediately and the writ is entered immediately unless it's stayed, which is what happened in this case. There was a stay of the writ to allow the parties to discuss the potential bond. And in this case, judgment was not entered immediately. That's pretty evident. But it didn't make any difference in Ms. Gay's case because what happened was Park Towers was ordered to give a bond if Ms. Gay appealed. And so under those circumstances, what the statute provides, and that's 504B.371, is that the writ issues notwithstanding the appeal. And so there's, in this particular case, there was no difference, no prejudice to Ms. Gay. And so to the extent that it was error or not best practices, our position is that it was harmless in this particular case. Certainly there could be cases, but this isn't one of them.
So are you representing that it is typical for the district court to enter judgment first and then issue the writ after entering judgment?
It's typical for the judge to enter, or for the court to enter judgment immediately. The reason for this is the eviction you don't get post-trial orders. Normally, from what I understand, judgment gets put off so that the parties can exchange any post-trial orders that they've got, look at attorney fees issues, things like that. In this case, the statute says you enter judgment immediately, and then in the separate sentence, it says the court shall tax costs, which was not actually requested in this case, so no costs were taxed, and immediately issue a writ of recovery of premises in order to vacate. So those two things are both important, but the issuance of the writ is not dependent on the court first entering judgment under the plain language of the statute.
Looking at, you made reference to point 371.
That was 345, but 371 is the appeal statute, yes.
Okay. Subdivision 7 of 371 says it's exceptions. Subdivisions 1, 4, and 6 do not apply in certain situations. It's your position, I take it, that the exception in subdivision 7 was triggered in this case?
It was, Your Honor. It was discussed at the with the court immediately after the court's entry of judgment, and Park Towers requested some time to figure out whether it was going to invoke Subdivision 7. And then it did, by letter, invoke Subdivision 7. And then the court ordered that Park Towers would provide a bond if Ms. Gay appealed. And it's a little bit unusual for the for somebody who's not appealing to have to provide a bond. And so the fact that the court ordered that the bond would be given, obviously Ms. Gay was the one who decided whether or not to appeal in this case. And it just simply doesn't make sense for Park Towers to have to jump through the hoops to get a bond. And there is in fact a bond. It's document number 64. The court said that it could be filed electronically, but to jump through those hoops and get that bond before the appeal really doesn't make sense. And the court had ordered that the bond be given and had ordered a specific amount. So it wasn't just Park Towers saying, oh yes, we'll do it. There was a court order in place that if there was an appeal, Park Towers would get this bond, which is what it did.
I don't know if you have 0.371 in front of you. If you don't, I'll read it. If you do, I'll just refer to it. But do you?
I have it here and I'm just looking to pull it up.
Well, subdivision 5, it's not one of the subdivisions mentioned in subdivision 7, but subdivision 5 says, if the court issues a writ before an appeal is taken, the appealing party may request that the court stay further proceedings and execution of the writ. And the court shall grant a stay. Now, the introductory clause says, except as provided in subdivision 7. Does that provision apply in this case? Is that procedure available in this case, or is it not because subdivision 7 operates?
Subdivision 7 operates, Your Honor. What happens is the party in possession of the premises is the one that gives the bond. And so if Ms. Gay had retained possession of the premises, then she would have had to provide the bond because the landlord elected to invoke subdivision 7. That means that the other sections of the subdivisions that specifically say except as provided in subdivision 7 were not operative.
Thank you.
And then I also just quickly want to address the retaliation defense. Park Towers is to the extent that the defense is even available, because it's our position that we don't get there because the mutual lease termination takes care of that. But to the extent that the retaliation defense was available, Park Towers is a nonprofit housing provider. It's in the business of housing people with affordable housing. It takes pride in that. There's testimony from building manager Round about how proud she is of the work that they're doing on the building. And it has to house 180 households in safe and sanitary conditions. And it can't do that if neighbors are endangered by failure to cooperate with bed bug treatment and failure to report bed bugs. Those things are so important that they're written right in the house rules. The house rules say that failure to follow these rules with regard to reporting bed bugs can lead to eviction. So they're pretty clear. And there is a great deal of testimony, and the trial court properly found that Park Towers had this legitimate reason for terminating the lease. And there is nothing in the record that controverts that. There's nothing in the record that establishes the existence of retaliation. As the trial court noted, appellant is basing her defense on one sentence in the lease termination notice where building director Round wrote, "It surprises me you can report this problem to building safety, but yet you forget to tell them you are the one with the bugs that you are not reporting." And that's an ambiguous sentence. Ms. Round testified at length regarding that. And the trial court found that the retaliation defense, there was just not, there was any evidence was legally insufficient when she granted the judgment as a matter of law. And so our position is the trial court was correct on all counts.
Anything else, counsel?
I think that will do it for me, thank you, unless the court has any further questions.
Anything else from the panel today? All right, thank you very much, counsel. 5 minutes for rebuttal, thank you. Go ahead. You need to turn off your mute, Mike, there you go.
Sorry.
Can you hold on 1 second, the marshal needs to reset the clock. Go ahead, counsel. Thank you.
It's come up, the fact that Ms. Gay does not testify. I don't know if anybody here has ever represented a person with a stroke. They're highly suggestionable. And that was a trial tactic based on my nearly 40 years of trial experience. I did not need her testimony to prove up the retaliation claim. And as I pointed out in my brief, this is like a Seinfeld episode where Banya says to Jerry after getting a good joke, "It's gold, Jerry." That is gold to get a statement like that in writing. It doesn't happen. I've been doing discrimination litigation for my whole career. People never admit doing something wrong. It was done wrong. This statement indicates that this landlord does not want a retired reporter, even though she suffered two strokes in their building, and that kind of.
So Mr. French, for your retaliation defense, you need evidence of a report, correct?
Yes.
And is there evidence of a report in the record?
Well, there's evidence that a landlord thinks there is a report. A report, does it have? I don't think it has to be written, does it? It could be oral report. And that sentence clearly states that they perceived her as going to the city to complain about the bed bug problem. I mean, who would have the temerity to do that? Just for starters, wouldn't you, if you were living in a building and they had this terrible bed bug problem, want to get the government involved? And they don't like that. They've had this problem for years. I wanted to say it's very untypical for a writ of recovery to be issued before judgment is entered. It doesn't happen. This case is probably going to stand for the proposition that a judgment in an eviction action is not important. In fact, you probably never need a judgment. Same thing, if somebody owes you $10,000, you can go out and pick up their property and just take it, even if you don't have a judgment. Judgments, this case is headed toward finding that judgment's not important in civil cases. I think that's wrong. I think it flies in the face of 500 years of Anglo-American jurisprudence. Shelter is an important human right. It's recognized by international treaties as an important human right. If you're in a high caste, shelter is is easily answered. Don't even worry about it. When you're a lady that has no family, no husband, suffered two strokes, and is going to be thrust out into the middle of the night, in the middle of the winter, that is, it doesn't take into any account of the importance of shelter in our culture. And it's going to become very important as we, as a growing homelessness here with families out in the street, when we start seeing that. I've been reading Justice Scalia's book about how to argue cases, which I find very interesting. And really, in this case, we have argued a lot. I have argued a lot about the facts. But this is what I call an intersectional issue. It involves not just the law, but involves society and culture. Does Anglo-American jurisprudence allow people to be as mean and nasty as they want? And then when they come to court, the court sanction it. After practicing law for 40 years, I think that that's becoming the reality of trial courts down here. For all those reasons, and like I said, I think the retaliation claim is solid. But again, I think this judge came into the courtroom knowing from the very beginning this case was going to be submitted to a jury. And like I said before, if I knew that this was going to be decided by the court, I wouldn't have wasted everybody's time in this case. But there is, through the summary judgment revolution, there is this belief that juries aren't important anymore in civil cases. And in England, they don't have juries in civil cases. But I think juries are important. I stand on 500 years of Anglo-American jurisprudence. It was totally improper and an abuse of discretion for this judge to grant a judgment as a matter of law without turning this case over to the jury for a decision, because I'm convinced that Ms. Gay would have prevailed in a jury trial. Thank you.
Anything else from the panel? All right. Thank you very much, counsel. We will take this matter under advisement and issue an opinion within the statutory time period. I want everyone to stay safe.